Well, here we are. If you missed the memo, didn't look at the calendar this morning, September has snuck up upon you, and that means that it is the first Sunday of the month, which means we will be observing communion a little bit later, which means we will be putting our sermon up toward the front. Mike in our Sunday school this morning made a great point that we typically think about God working through his word, and he does. And we therefore typically think about God working through the preaching of his word, and he does. But we don't typically think about the other ways by which God works in our hearts, the other ways by which God molds us and fashions us and shapes us. And one of those is, of course, the moment when you were baptized. And one of those is absolutely every month when we observe communion together. These are ways, and of course by prayer as well, these are all ways that God fashions us and molds us and shapes us into his own image, into the image of his dear son. And so I think it's fitting, therefore, that we, of course, not neglect the public reading of the word and the preaching of the word. We're not going to do that. We're not going to say, well, it's communion Sunday, so there'll be no sermon. But we are going to and have moved it early so that we can throw our attention appropriately and correctly toward communion at the end of our time as well. So here we are in Esther chapter 3. I did all that talking, and then I didn't bother to go to Esther chapter 3 myself. But we're in Esther chapter 3. And so we've seen so far in our story, fascinating. So far in our story, what we've really seen is that no one is aware of the great and pressing need for rescue, except God, of course. And we've seen everything working in the backstory. Today, we humans are going to begin to see the pressing need for rescue. As we come to Esther chapter 3, as is my habit, I want to read this text and hope that you'll follow along. As has been my habit, instead of Ahasuerus, I'm going to say Xerxes, the more common name by which he's known. After these things, King Xerxes promoted Haman the Agagite, the son of Hammedatha, and advanced him and set his throne above all the officials who were with him. And all the king's servants who were at the king's gate bowed down and paid homage to Haman, for the king had so commanded concerning him. But Mordecai did not bow down or pay homage. Then the king's servants who were at the king's gate said to Mordecai, "Why do you transgress the king's command?" And when they spoke to him day after day, and he would not listen to them, they told Haman, in order to see whether Mordecai's words would stand, for he had told them that he was a Jew. And when Haman saw that Mordecai did not bow down or pay homage to him, Haman was filled with fury. But he disdained to lay hands on Mordecai alone. So, as they had made known to him the people of Mordecai, Haman sought to destroy all the Jewish people, the people of Mordecai, throughout the whole kingdom of Xerxes. In the first month, which is the month of Nisan, in the 12th year of King Xerxes, they cast pur, which is a word that means lots, before Haman day after day, and they cast it month after month until the 12th month, which is the month of Adar. Then Haman said to King Xerxes, "There was a certain people scattered abroad and dispersed among the peoples in all the provinces of your kingdom. Their laws are different from those of every other people, and they do not keep the king's laws, so that it is not to the king's profit to tolerate them. If it please the king, let it be decreed that they be destroyed, and I will pay the absolutely ridiculous sum of 10,000 talents of silver into the hands of those who have charge of the king's business, that they may put it into the king's treasuries." So the king took his signet ring from his hand and gave it to Haman the Agagite, the son of Hammedatha, the enemy of the Jews. And the king said to Haman, "The money is given to you, the people also. Do to them as it seems good to do." Then the king's scribes were summoned on the 13th day of the first month, and an edict, according to all that Haman commanded, was written to the king's satraps and to the governors of all the provinces and to the officials of all the peoples, to every province in its own script and every people in its own language. It was written in the name of King Xerxes and sealed with the king's signet ring. Letters were sent by couriers to all the king's provinces with instructions to destroy, to kill, and to annihilate all Jews, young and old, women and children, in one day, the 13th day of the 12th month, which is the month of Adar, and to plunder their goods. A copy of the document was to be issued as a decree in every province by proclamation to all the peoples to be ready for that day. The couriers went out hurriedly by order of the king, and the decree was issued in Susa, the citadel. The king and Haman sat down to drink, but the city of Susa was thrown into confusion. God, thank you for this increased amount of information that we now have. Thank you for revealing to us, your audience, that there's a real pressure, there's a real problem, and it's a problem above our ability to really reckon with, Lord. We are, in this modern day, unaccustomed to reading about such violent, genocidal, awful plotting and planning. And it seems natural, Lord, that our minds jump quickly back to Germany and the Second World War and Adolf Hitler, and here it is, sort of prefigured for us almost. God, these are dark words. These are hard words. They're things that we generally don't want to think about or talk about. And so this morning as we do, I pray that we not become mired in the harshness of it, not become mired in the real despicableness of it, but that we understand it, and more importantly then, that we understand you. I pray, God, that you would reveal yourself to us this morning through your word, as your word is the way you primarily reveal yourself to us. I pray that you would do so. God, thank you for this family of families and our opportunity to learn from the Word in our own language and freedom and security and in print and on screens and all the different ways that we can do that we so often take for granted. Lord, this morning, help us to be appreciative of the power, the majesty of your Word. Amen. So as we've said, we've seen a few things going on. We've seen a few things going on so far in context with Esther, and that is we've seen the growing wisdom of Esther. At the beginning of the book, we knew nothing about Esther at all except that she's pretty. That's really about all. We knew a little bit about her background. We don't really know what happened to her parents exactly. She is Jewish. She is pretty. The end. That's about all we knew. And then we saw last week some indication that this is a wise young woman. She made a wise decision about how to handle her affairs and take good counsel from someone who would know more things than what she did. We also, of course, saw some direct foreshadowing of events to come. So we saw in miniature, played out at the end of chapter 2, kind of the broad narrative of what's played out in the book of Esther. And, of course, we've been following this grand rescue plan. And I hope by now you've figured out that the grand rescue plan for the people of Mordecai, for the people of Esther, is big and grand and powerful and amazing in its scope. But really, it just sort of prefigures for us the even bigger rescue plan of God to redeem a people unto himself, of Christ to come as the ultimate sacrifice on our behalf. And we'll be talking more about that in the coming weeks. For now, chapter 3 today has to get us into the problem. Now, we cheated, right? We know the story ahead of time. So when we came to the book of Esther, we already knew that there was trouble brewing. But if you had actually lived back then, if we were among those many, many Jewish people living in the Persian Empire, we wouldn't have known that. If we were Esther, if we were Mordecai, we wouldn't have known those things. So we come to the book having read it and having known the story a little bit ahead of time. We already know that there was trouble brewing. And look, here's God at work. But I want to emphasize, no one knew, save God alone, that these problems were about to brew. Because we read in chapter 3, verse 1, after these things, Xerxes promoted Haman. He's an Agagite. His dad's name is Hammedatha. And he advanced him and set his throne above all the officials who were with him. Okay? Now that happens fairly typically in ancient courts. It's not unusual in the ancient governments of the world for there to be a king. In fact, all of the world's ancient governments were basically dictatorships. We just call them monarchies. If you like them, you call them monarchies. If you don't, you call them dictatorships, right? All of the world's ancient governments were basically dictatorships, but as kingdoms grew and became empires, so those two words do mean different things. A kingdom just means you control your own land. You become an empire when you conquer someone else's kingdom and control it too. It doesn't have to be a big chunk of land, but somebody else's lands you've conquered and you've now controlled them and you've told them you're the boss of them too. That makes you an empire. As empires got bigger, eventually most of the ancient kings in the world said, I can't micromanage this all myself. I got to have somebody to help me, right? And so think specifically of Joseph in Genesis being called a vizier. Do you remember that word? That's one of the many words that people would use. It's the right-hand man. So inevitably, not absolutely always, but very commonly in the ancient world, some empire has a king. And then eventually he appoints somebody that is answerable only to the king. He's functionally a mini king. All the people of the empire have to treat him with just about the same level of respect and authority as they would have to treat the king himself. And that frees the king up to do whatever it is that he feels he wants to do. And as we've already seen, Xerxes is pretty shallow and pretty vapid and pretty power hungry, so we might guess the things that he wants to do. And he's leaving Haman in charge of doing some of these other things. It's also worth noting, although the Bible doesn't give us any indication of how, in the same way that we talked about the women in the harem kind of constantly trying the gamesmanship to get themselves to the prize of being the principal wife, so too the courtiers of these men, they would involve themselves in a little intrigue and a little gamesmanship and a little one-upping of each other to try desperately to become that right-hand man, whether he's a vizier or whatever other title is used by them. And as a consequence of this, it just became normal and customary that you're supposed to treat the right-hand man in the same way that you would anybody else. In fact, if we continue in the text, it tells us in verse 2, all of the king's servants who were at the king's gate bowed down and paid homage to Haman, for the king had so commanded concerning him. Now, it may be, there's two ways of reading that. It may be that Xerxes specifically said, attention Persian world, all y'all got to pay homage to Haman. It might be. It probably isn't, though. What probably happened was it's just a law, and Xerxes renews the law. Whoever my right-hand man is, like, that guy deserves your homage. That guy deserves your almost worship. That guy deserves to be bowed to, et cetera, et cetera. So don't think that there's something so special about Haman that Xerxes has gone out of his way to say, look, I know I've had guys, my right-hand man before, but like this guy you got to bow to. It's just become customary, and it's actually law. And so we're told there in scriptures that Xerxes had so commanded, keeping with an old ancient tradition, that this is what you do with the king's right-hand man. There was, presumably, a king's right-hand man before Haman, and we're not told his name, and I'm unaware that the history books tell us his name either. And now we've got a new one. I find it interesting that the Bible doesn't answer any of the questions that are now swirling in your mind, right? Many of you right now are wondering, who was in charge before him? How did Haman get the gig? What did Haman do? Was Haman well-connected? Was it? The Bible just doesn't answer any of that because it's not the point. The point of the passage isn't Haman. In fact, as you'll see very quickly, Haman goes from being Haman the Agagite to being Haman the enemy of the Jews. Did you catch that when we read that? That's the moniker by which this guy is known. Okay, so we find out at the end of verse 2, Mordecai did not bow down or pay homage. And notice that the Bible is also not answering the questions that are now swirling in your head. How come? Why not? Why is, it must be because he's Jewish and Jewish people don't bow to, there's all kinds of examples of Jewish people bowing to kings in the Bible. All kinds of examples of Jewish people bowing to kings and those in authority over them and humbling themselves and falling on their face before them. There's all kinds of examples of that. There's nothing anti-Jewish about bowing to someone who is in authority over you, showing respect to someone who is in authority over you. Nothing anti-biblical about that, right? In fact, the Bible in the New Testament makes even more clear to pay honor to whom honor is due. And, I mean, this guy's your boss, so there's some measure of honor due to him. So, Mordecai, what's up? Why are you not? The Bible doesn't answer it. So I'm not going to, well, I'll give you a little hint. It might be, and we don't know this, guys, but it might be. Remember when we just read that he is an Agagite? If you follow the history books backward far enough into time, you find out that Haman's ancestors had been awful, I mean terribly, awfully violent to the Jewish people. So it might be that Mordecai is remembering the history books and remembering that this guy's family has been more than a jerk. He's been just despicably awful, his family has, to the Jewish people. Maybe. Or maybe he knows something about Haman that the Bible's just not filling us in on. Or it just doesn't. That's not the point. The point of the text is not to try to answer those questions that we naturally have. So someday, you know, when you're in glory, you can ask about those things. But in the meantime, it's kind of not the point. So verse 3 then, the king's servants who were at the king's gate said to Mordecai, they want to know just like you do, why do you transgress the king's command? Dude, why are you not showing homage? And apparently Mordecai was in no mood to address these questions because they spoke to him day after day and he wouldn't listen. So every day they're bugging this dude. Why are you not bowing to Haman? Like, hello, what's going on? Do you know something we don't know? What's your reason? Tell us. And he's got no time for those questions, apparently, because he just seems to be ignoring them. He's not answering them. And so finally, seemingly appropriately, they go up the chain of command, and like, we talk to the guy directly, and he won't talk to us, so I guess we'll go to his boss. They told Haman in order to see whether Mordecai's words would stand. And he had told them that he was Jewish. Now, the way the ESV reads here, it says, before he had told them that he was a Jew. It kind of implies that these things are connected. The actual Hebrew text doesn't really make that case. The Hebrew text just kind of throws these two things together. It says that they went to Haman to see if Mordecai was okay, and also they knew that he was Jewish. Now, those two things are about to come together. But I don't want you to read this and think, oh, I see what it is. So the only reason they're actually going to talk to Haman is because they're anti-Semitic. They've got something against the Jewish. The text doesn't really read that way. So they go to their boss and they say, hey, is this okay? I mean, you know, have you noticed that he doesn't bow? Maybe he hadn't even noticed. I mean, there's a sea of people bowing to him all the time. My guess is eventually you just kind of stop even noticing that people are bowing to you every time you walk in a room. I don't know, I've never had people bow to me when I walked in a room, but I'm guessing that eventually you just kind of become oblivious to that, and you don't really notice it anymore, you don't really think about it anymore. And so maybe they just, have you even noticed this? Is this okay with you? And oh, by the way, you know, we were talking to the guy, you know, it turns out he's Jewish, whatever that means, and they may or not have understood a lot about what it meant to be Jewish. Probably for them, that's strictly an ethnic designation. More than likely, it meant, you know, I am from Moab, and you are from, Assyria, and you are from Judea. Probably that's all it meant to them. But he's different. We'll talk more about that in just a moment here. So, by the way, I don't know if you knew this or not, but he's Jewish, and he's not bowing to you, so. And in verse 5, when Haman saw that Mordecai did not bow down or pay homage, Haman was filled with fury. And so we get these really, really critical words, for he had told them that he was a Jew, that he was a Jewish person. And it does make you wonder, does it not? Like, why? The Bible goes out of its way in the first couple of chapters to say Mordecai consistently told Esther, don't tell anybody that you're Jewish. Keep your lineage a secret. Don't tell anybody about your family tree. And then now here we just kind of casually, oh yeah, he told these guys that he was Jewish. I don't want Esther outing herself as Jewish, but he just kind of seems to have. And again, the Bible gives us no indication about why or when that had happened and whatnot. It's worth remembering the history a little bit here, guys. So we are now only about, depending on who you talk to, we are only 75 maybe years after Nebuchadnezzar destroyed the temple. So if you remember your Bible history, you've got Nebuchadnezzar marches into town and he attacks Jerusalem and he destroys the walls and he destroys the temple and he carries away Daniel and Rakshak and Beni, right? Hananiah, Azariah, Mishael. And they're in captivity and the book of Daniel commences and it's all doom and gloom and the Babylonians are terrible and it's awful and what's going to happen. And we saw earlier this summer that was actually all prophesied, that this is going to happen to deal with the brokenness and sin within your own camp, dear Jewish people. And then along came the Persians, along with their good buddies, the Medes. Later they weren't their good buddies. But anyway, they came along with the Persians and the Medes, and they took over. And it's only been a couple of generations since this has happened. So Mordecai himself is probably not old enough to have actually been there the day when the Persians showed up and the Babylonians fell and the Persians took control. Probably not. If he was, he was very, very young at the moment that that happened. But it's only been a couple generations, and he remembers, and he knows, okay? Have you ever spent any time talking to someone today from Germany? And has the subject of World War II come up? It's a little different than we talk about World War II, guys. I've had several German exchange students over the years. One German exchange student told me in no uncertain terms, we were talking about, of all things, you maybe didn't know this, most people don't know this, the swastika is actually originally a Hindu symbol, and then Adolf Hitler adopted it for himself, right? Because the Aryan people started the Hindu religion, and he's got this whole Aryan thing going on, and so he stole their religious symbol, and he turned it into a good luck symbol in his own regime. And so we are one day talking about Hinduism, and I put up an image on the screen that's got some weird elephant-headed god, and in his hand, he's got a swastika. And my German exchange student kind of recoiled from that. And I said to her name was Tabia, I said, Tabia, what? She goes, you don't understand, Mr. Hyde. In German schools, if I so much as doodled a swastika on the side of my paper, they would expel me. She said, we don't play around with this stuff. Like, we're kind of pretty well embarrassed by the memory of what happened. So, okay. Because we didn't live it, right? But we're all of us young enough to remember, like, it wasn't all that long ago. There are actually a handful of people still left alive who were there. That's about the same scenario that we find ourselves here in Esther. So Mordecai has been telling Esther, his adopted daughter, basically, he's been telling her, look, man, I know what happens when people know that you're Jewish. The temple gets destroyed and Babylon takes over and it's captivity and it's bad. And so just don't tell anybody that you're Jewish. And then he just somehow just, what is that? That's a strange thing. Can we guess that maybe he's become really, really comfortable with these men and he feels confident in telling them a little bit more of his deeper secrets? Maybe that's what's going on. Maybe not. Again, the Bible doesn't tell us. Maybe it was just a slip of the tongue. Maybe he didn't mean to. Oops, didn't mean to tell. The Bible doesn't really tell us why this had happened. And I think the reason for that, folks, is we're supposed to be looking at the hands of providence here. We're not supposed to be asking all the, like, as if this were a movie, we would be saying, man, the director really dropped it there. He's supposed to fill us in on these things, right? This isn't a film. This is God's narrative. This is providence in action. And so it isn't really the point how or why these kind of particular things happen. The point is that God is aware of these things and he's at work behind the scenes. And we've already seen two chapters worth of this rescue plan being built and rolling into motion. So we don't have to fret too much about the particular details of why this had happened. Now, as I just read to you a minute ago, verse 5 is a strange one, is it not? And then verse 6 is worse. Haman saw that Mordecai wouldn't bow, and so he's filled with fury. Well, maybe, I guess, if he thinks a little too highly of himself, he's a very proud man, maybe. But then verse 6, he disdained to lay hands on Mordecai alone. So as they had made known to him the people of Mordecai, that is, they told him that he was Jewish, Haman sought to destroy all the Jewish people throughout the entire kingdom? Like, what on earth? You have personally offended me, therefore I'm going to try to get a law passed that will literally exterminate every single member of your family generations deep. Like, that is a whole different kind of awful. And I'm happy to say, like, that thought like that's never crossed my mind. I doubt highly that it's ever crossed any of your minds. You ever been so furiously mad that you not only wished somebody dead, but you wished literally everyone genetically related to them dead? Like, no. What in the world? Well, the nice fancy word for this is xenophobia. It's a combination of a couple Greek words. Xenos is an old Greek word that means stranger. Means somebody who isn't from around here. And of course, phobia, you all know, is a word that means fear. So this is fear of strangers. This is fear of people who aren't locals. You ever been in one of those towns where you get that you ain't from around here kind of sense? Carmen and I in college, I'm a year older than she. And so her junior year in college, we were married and our spring breaks coincided. And so we're gonna go on spring break. And we didn't know where we were going to go. This is kind of, the internet existed, but it wasn't like you had it in your pocket. So we said, well, we'll just drive south, and then when we get down into Kentucky, we'll buy a USA Today. Dear young people, that used to be the best source of weather because they had, like, color weather maps. And so y'all remember that? USA Today was where it was at. So we'll pay. It was expensive, too. We'll pay, like, $1 or $1.50 for a copy of USA Today so we can get a weather map, and then we'll just go east or west, depending on whatever the weather's going to be nice, because it's, you know, spring break, which was like late February. That's great. So we're going to find someplace warm. Well, anyway, on our journey, we ended up in some absolutely one-stoplight, middle of nowhere, deep in the hollers of Kentucky kind of town. And it was breakfast time, and I hate to admit it, it was a McDonald's. There's nothing else here, man. I got to get something to eat. And so we pulled into this little You ever been to a place that this happened? The instant we walked through the door, you walk through the door, and it's all and then we walk through the door. Literally every head in the place turned. And you know, you want to be like, hi, I mean, one of those kinds of, you ain't from around here kind of moments. We didn't stay long. You ain't from around here. That's xenophobia. That's this I'm uncomfortable with, or I'm afraid of, or I'm nervous about, or I don't like people that are strange, people that aren't from around here, people that are different. But here's the thing, guys. We live in a world where xenophobia is really common, right? We live in a world right now where there's all kinds of people in this world that don't like other people because they're strange to them. But in the ancient world, that was kind of normal. Think about the size of the Persian Empire. The Persian Empire is gigantic. It's somewhere on the order of, well, it's more than two-thirds the size of the United States, which in the ancient world was huge. And there's all these different ethnicities, and there's all these different languages and cultures, and they'd all come together, and they'd learn. They didn't like each other, don't get me wrong. They still kind of congregated together. We humans, there's something about us. We just like people that are like us. We just do. So we tend to congregate into groups of people that are like us in various ways, speak the same language as us, or have the same religion as us, or like the same sports teams as us, or whatever. Like, we do that. We just kind of congregate. And so they did. In the Persian Empire, there's pockets all over the place of different ethnic and cultural groups, but they're all part of Persia, and they all pay their taxes, and they all do their thing, and it's okay. And all of a sudden, Haman shows up, and he's got this deep, awful xenophobia. What is that? You can't. My point here, guys, you cannot simply write this off as, well, that's just how people were back then. Nuh-uh. That's not just how people were back then. There is something particularly awful about Haman. And so when the Bible a little bit later singles him out as, quote, the enemy of the Jews, that's fitting. Haman, we're being told in no uncertain terms, if you missed it, we're being told Haman is among the worst of the worst of the worst. This is a terrible, awful, bad dude. He's not just a product of his times. He's a terribly, awfully bad human being. And so, because he's got this genocidal thought in his head, he's got this crazy idea. So in the first month, in the month of Nisan, I'm in verse 7 now, he decides that he's going to cast lots to determine the day of destruction. Lots, there's all kinds of different lots in the ancient world. Often they were knuckle bones. That's kind of gross, but often they were. We don't know here what kind of lots they were, but incidentally, the Bible gives you the word poor there. That's actually a Persian word that ends up getting adopted into Hebrew, and that's why the author of Esther feels necessary to tell you what the word means. But anyway, often they were knuckle bones, and you've read enough of Bible to know that throughout both the Old Testament and actually a little bit into the New Testament period, people did this to discern the will of God. And it seems that when people tried to make wise choices and they had prayed and they still couldn't figure out what they were supposed to do, there are occasions in the Old Testament and even a few in the New Testament where people cast lots and said, okay, God, reveal yourself to us. Give us what we're supposed to do. Never as a replacement. Never in the Bible does anybody ever go, well, we haven't thought about this at all. We haven't sought any wise counsel, and we certainly haven't prayed. Let's just roll some dice and figure it out. Like, that doesn't happen. That never happens in the Scriptures. And I also think it's interesting to note that you literally can't find an example of the casting of lots after Pentecost. And so it now seems, and most of us would argue, that because we have the completed Scriptures, because we have the Holy Spirit at work within us through the completed Scriptures, we don't need to be casting lots anymore, guys. So I'm not going to advise you, nobody's ever going to advise you, that if you can't figure out God's will, get some dice and roll it and try to enter. No, that's not going to happen. But this is what Haman is doing. Haman, on the other hand, unlike the Bible's uses of lots, Haman does not appear to be looking for, like, insight and wisdom. He just literally appears to be going, I don't really care when we kill him, let's see. He's that calloused? You're going to determine, you've already decided in your heart that you want genocide. And you care so little about these people as to just literally roll dice to randomly determine when they're going to be wiped out. That's Haman. That's who this guy is. So here's another way that the author of Esther is telling us, the reader, guys, he's not just a product of his times. He's despicably awful, more so than the norm. And then he goes to the king. He goes to the king and he says, hey, there's this people. Did you notice the way he said it? There is a certain people. The Hebrew word that he uses there is the single most generic word possible for people. It's not tribe, it's not family, it's not lineage, it's not nation. It's literally the most generic word in the Hebrew tongue. And so it's translated as people, because this is what it means. There's a people scattered abroad among the other people, same word, in your kingdom. And their laws are different from people's law, same words. Just keeping this like super generic. How come? Well, presumably because he doesn't want any chance that Xerxes thinks of a reason to stop this. Right? He didn't want Xerxes to stop this for any reason whatsoever. So he's not going to name any particular names. He's not going to give you labels. He's not going to give you details. He also apparently cares so very little about them as to not get into any of that. The point is, I want them dead. And he even goes so far as to offer this astronomical amount of money. Guys, 10,000 talents of silver. The single best way I can explain this to you is this. If you take, and we know from the history books, the entire annual average income of Persia. So if you take all the taxes that are collected in Persia, all the money that the Persian kings received in taxes in a given year, 10,000 talents is two-thirds of that amount of money. He's offering him, in the modern terms, I mean, this is billions of dollars that he's offering him. This is how crazy he is. This is how broken this man is. But you might ask yourself, how's he got that much money? Well, he probably doesn't. Nobody did. So what is he thinking? And many scholars have argued his plan is probably, I'm going to kill all the Jewish people. I'm going to confiscate all their stuff, all their land, all their everything, all their wealth. And with that money, I will pay this ridiculous sum, and I'll probably still have some left over. Which has led many scholars to suggest that maybe the Jewish people are prospering in Persia. That maybe in the 75 or so years since they were liberated by the Babylonians, things are going really, really well for the Jewish people here in Persian captivity. The Persians were generally pretty chill. They were generally pretty gracious with their enslaved people. They weren't harsh taskmasters usually. And it seems that things are going pretty well because Haman thinks that he can get this ridiculous sum of money by selling their property. Don't think, oh, this is just hyperbole. He sure, no, you don't use hyperbole with the king. If you tell the king you're going to pay him 10,000 talents of silver, and then when it comes time to pay, you're like, well, of course I didn't actually mean that. Like, that's not going to fly, right? That is not going to work. So this isn't hyperbole. He apparently genuinely thought that he could get that kind of money. And so the king, typical of what we've seen of Xerxes so far, kind of shallow, kind of vapid, self-absorbed. The king says, okay. Verse 10, king took his signet ring from his hand and gave it to Haman. Like, whoa. The signet ring is essentially the voice of the king. It is essentially the crown of the king. It is essentially the power of the king. So if somebody comes to me, and I actually wear a signet ring, more or less, if you've ever looked at this thing, Grace Seminary gave me this when I graduated. Funny, real brief story on that. I wasn't going to buy this. Like, why? I don't want. I already spent thousands of dollars to get the degree. Why am I going to buy a ring? And I got a phone call from Grace Seminary a couple weeks before the last semester, and they said, "Hey, you haven't come in to size your ring yet." And I was like, "Look, man, I got a family, and like I love me some Grace College, but I'm not gonna. This is not going to happen." She goes, "No. You're getting an MDiv. They're free." I said, "I'll be right down." So I came down and got sized for a ring. So it is technically a signet ring. If you've ever looked at it, it's got the seal of Grace Seminary on it. It's got some cool Greek words on it. It's a little shield. It's kind of fun, right? So in the ancient world, what I would do if I were the king is you would come to me and you would say, "Hey, King Nathan, we want to do X, Y, or Z." And I would say, "Okay, sounds like a pretty good plan." We would write it up. We'd get some wax. We'd put some wax on the paper. I would take my ring, and I would push it into the wax, let it cool a little bit, pull it out, and it would leave my mark, and then everybody would know. It's essentially a signature, like a verifiable signature, like your social security number or something pretty secure. This was their version, their ancient version of that. But once again, guys, notice the kind of shallow, thoughtless man that Xerxes is. He gave the signet ring to Haman. In theory, Haman could run out and sign anything he wants and put that signet ring on it and do all kinds of mischief. Now, he'd have to be careful he doesn't tick off the king or he's going to get dead, but he could probably sign into law all kinds of new money for himself, nice new digs for himself, new wardrobe for himself. He could do about anything he wanted to with this signet ring. And more than likely, there's actually a little debate here, but verse 11, the king said to Haman, "The money is given to you, the people also, do with them as seems good." Most scholars believe that that's Xerxes saying, "Keep your money." Some don't. Some scholars actually think this is Xerxes saying, "It's your money. If you want to waste it, feel free." So, I mean, it might be that Haman actually has to pay this sum of money, but it looks more probably that Haman now has the signet ring and gets to keep this massive sum of money from after he confiscates and sells all the property of the Jewish people. So at the beginning of chapter 3, he's elevated to vizier. He's got all this power. Now he's got even more. And at this point, if we stopped the story right here, you're going, there is nobody, no one in Persia who is set up for success more than Haman. I mean, this guy is where it's at. Well, maybe not. So we read in verse 12, the king's scribes are summoned, and they write all this stuff out. You see an interesting word there in verse 12. It says, was written to the king's satraps. Satrap is actually a Persian word, and it means like the governor's governor. So the kingdom of Persia, the empire of Persia, was divided up into, I can't remember off the top of my head, I feel like it was 20-odd, big chunks. And there was a satrap in charge of that, and then each chunk was further subdivided, and then they put governors in charge of each of those little subdivisions. So this is an authentic Persian word, just like pur, we saw that one a minute ago. So it's written to the king's satraps and to the governors over all the provinces and to all the other little government guys, so to everybody. Notice it says, in its own script and every people in its own language. This is a reminder of what I said a minute ago. There's a lot of ethnic groups of people that make up Persia. So many that they've got to write in all these different languages so that everybody knows what the rule is. And it was written, of course, in the name of Xerxes and sealed with his ring, because Haman's got his ring. And they sent these letters by courier to all the provinces. The Persians were actually smart enough. They're among the very first people in the history of the world to build a highway. They called it the King's Highway. They called it the Royal Road. King's Highway is a different road. They called it the Royal Road. And it runs in a modern map. If you can picture, Italy is over here kicking the little ball, right? And then we come this way, and there's the dangly down thing that's Greece. And then you come over, and there's the big bump that is Turkey, okay? That road ran from the coast of Turkey right all the way down into Iraq. It's a big, long road that they built, specifically so they could move armies quickly and move messengers quickly. So when we read that the couriers were sent hurriedly, more than likely they're using the Royal Road and they're getting out there ASAP. We got to get the news out. And what is the news? One more glimpse into just exactly how broken Haman is. To destroy all of the Jewish people. Well, no, in case that would, to destroy and to kill them. You know what, actually, I want you to destroy, kill, and annihilate. When I read that this last week preparing the sermon, I went, come on, man, what is this? Some kind of, so I go back to the Hebrew text. I'm like, no, it literally says it's the three distinct verbs. It's not, this is not your English translation's way of trying to explain a metaphor. No, the text literally uses these three words. I want you to destroy them, to kill them, and to annihilate them. Isn't that a little bit redundant? That's a lot redundant. This is how awful a human being Haman is. Destroy them, kill them, annihilate them. Young and old. Women and children. And then gives a specific day. And when they're dead, you get to plunder their goods. Now, of course, he's planning on taking, you know, the profits from this. And a copy of this is sent all over, and everybody's out and about. Everybody is being made aware of this. And so now, at long last, we the reader, again, pretend you're reading this for the first time, we're not cheating, we the reader now finally see, oh man, we need a rescuer. Somebody's got to come to the rescue. Somebody's got to come redeem this situation. We need a hero. Somebody's got to do something. And then we're reminded, because we read chapter 1 and 2, That's why God's got the wheels already in motion. Can you imagine reading this story? Do you remember maybe what it was like for you the very first time you became familiar with this story? Did you have kind of an aha moment? Go, oh man, I see what's happening now. But remember, guys, Esther still doesn't. Esther, we know. Mordecai knows. All of the Jewish people scattered throughout the Persian government know this, but it's highly unlikely that anyone in the palace knows or cares. Okay? The need for the rescue. And then I think it's fitting that the last verse of chapter 3, the couriers were hurriedly there. So the picture is they're scattered and they're rushed and they're going out real quick and they got to send this order out and the decree was issued at Susa and the city is in confusion and people are talking about this and they're excited about this or they're sad about this or they're worried about this or they're anxious about this. But, you know, the king and Haman, they're just sitting down to drink. Exactly how calloused are you? Dear king, you're so vapid. You're so clueless, so shallow. And dear Haman, you are so absolutely evil that you have literally just thrown the entire Persian kingdom into chaos. And your response? Let's have a drink. That is not a good look, right? Once upon a time in the Great Depression, I'll show my political cards here, I guess, a little bit. Franklin Delano Roosevelt, president, considered by many to be a great president. There's actually a lot of data to suggest that he made the Great Depression a whole lot worse and created a depression within a depression. And so by 1937, we should have been good, but he creates this depression within a depression. So in 1937, when all kinds of industries that were starting to recover crashed, like the steel industry. Can you imagine this? If you worked in the steel industry, the steel industry lost 2/3 of its business in 6 months nationwide. FDR's response? He went on a 7-day long fishing trip. And Americans went, dude, that is not a good look. We're freaking out here. We're in chaos. We're in confusion. What are you doing? Here's Xerxes and Haman. Everything is in chaos. Everything is in turmoil. We're doing what? We're killing how many people? When? Who are these people? What? That's my neighbor? Everybody is freaking out. And Haman and Xerxes are just like, yeah, let's just have a drink. So the moral of the story, guys, is what we've got going on in chapter 3 are three distinct personages. We've got three distinct figures. We've got Haman, who is diabolically evil. And every one of us in the room says, man, I'm glad I'm not that guy. And I'm here as a preacher to remind you, you could be. So could I. If circumstances were different, there's every reason to believe that if you or I had been in Haman's shoes, you or I could have been just as bad. Every one of us in this room is capable of being a Stalin or a Hitler or a Xerxes or a Haman. That's our brokenness. That's the depth of our depravity. That's why we need a rescue plan. Like Esther and Mordecai, you as a younger person probably were blissfully unaware of your need to be rescued. But we now know better. And then we've got Xerxes, who just seems about as calloused as possible. Oh, there's like a whole bunch of people that you want to kill? I mean, I suppose maybe I should ask who these people are. No, 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 here you go, here's my ring. Like, what? And every one of us in the room goes, man, I'm glad I'm not like that guy. But you could be. So could I. That's the depth of our sin, guys. That's the depth of our depravity. And woven through all of it is this promise of God made generations earlier that he will preserve and protect his people, that he's got a plan to call a people to himself. And we see it in miniature here in the people of God, the Jewish people in the time of Esther, and we see it in all of its great fullness later in history as Jesus, the Messiah, the Redeemer, calling the elect to himself. To put it very bluntly, guys, Esther is a gorgeous, beautiful picture of the bride of Christ. And we'll be exploring that a little bit more as we go forward. Okay? Next week, we're going to bring Esther back into the story. next week we're going to see. What does Esther have? What is her role in all of this? Is she going to keep growing in wisdom and understanding, or is she going to fall back to all we know about her is she's pretty? Well, you know how the story goes. If you don't, read it. Even if you do, read it. Okay? Would you bow with me as we pray? Father God, thank you for the opportunity that we have to see you at work, to see providence, to see promise maybe isn't even strong enough a word, Lord. It's covenant. These binding promises made based not just on the word of man, but on your enduring character to provide for your people, to preserve a remnant, to call a people to yourself, to glorify yourself, to make your name great. These and so many other promises you have made, and you've kept them, and we see that throughout the Old Testament and the New Testament and throughout human history. You've proven yourself over and over again, God, to be full of faithfulness and loving kindness and covenant faithfulness, that word we talked about over the summer. God, we praise you for that. We praise you specifically for preserving the Jewish people in the time of Esther and Xerxes. We praise you, God, for being a God who not only knows but also cares, and not only knows and cares but is all-powerful and can take action to resolve these things that you're never surprised by. God, thanks for recording it so that we can be encouraged by it here all these many, many years later. Father, we've reached a part in our service now. We're going to get a chance to show our thanks in a different way. We've shown our thanks to you through song this morning and through prayer this morning and through the listening to and understanding of your word this morning. Now we have a chance to show our appreciation, Father, through the taking up of tithes and offerings. And I pray that as we continue moving forward into a new facility and with new opportunities and new costs and challenges, that you will, as you have throughout the Old and the New Testament and throughout human history and throughout our personal little history, that you will continue to provide. You will continue to make your name great. Use us, Lord, in whatever way possible to advance your kingdom and the glory of your name. And I pray this in Jesus' name. Amen.